Welcome to Mortgage Space. I'm your host, Alan Medeiros, and today we have the pleasure of talking with Mark Kamyab, a certified residential appraiser. He's taken the time out of his busy schedule, in between appraisals of all things, to sit down with us and have a conversation about being an appraiser, what goes into appraisals, and all the questions that you've been dying to ask. So I want to give a quick introduction. Mark and his team have over 30,000 hours of experience in residential appraising, and I think that the mark of expertise really comes from just doing it and doing it all the time. And one of the things that's really impressed me about Mark is his team's efforts to be not only a team player with regards to their relationships with banks, but also in providing the highest quality of service and speed and efficiency within the marketplace. So Mark, with that introduction, is there anything you want to add that I didn't?
Well, thanks for having me, Alan. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Absolutely. So this would be a real casual conversation. I'm going to kind of lead it with some questions, and wherever that takes us, we'll go ahead and go. So give me a little bit more background on you as far as your appraisal experience in general.
Well, my appraisal experience in general started around the time when the real estate boom of the early 2000s started taking place. At that time, the real estate industry was just you know, hitting on all cylinders. Everything was going so fast. And at that time, I had recently graduated from college and I was looking for a job, looking for a career. And appraising wasn't something that, you know, I dreamed of becoming when I was a kid. I didn't even know it was a thing.
You know, kids want to become firefighters. They want to become, you know, jet pilots. They want to become doctors. But nobody says they want to become an appraiser, right?
Very true. Very true. And my first job out of college, I was actually teaching English to Japanese students, making $12 an hour, 15 hours a week. It was a lot of fun, but not enough to pay the rent.
Absolutely.
So I had an opportunity to apprentice with a friend's father, my friend who I went to school with, and his father had been an appraiser for 35 years, and he had an appraisal firm, and he was looking to hire people to service his clients. And one of the thoughts he had was, you know, instead of just hiring a random person that he didn't know, he wanted to employ some of his son's college-educated friends, which was awesome. So he was creating jobs, and he also did that, I think, with his own for his own reasons as well. One being that he wanted to instill a certain mentality and a certain workflow and a certain level of expectation, and he thought that doing that with people that came in with a clean slate was going to be a lot easier. So that's how I got in the business. I was really fortunate to be trained by someone with that amount of experience right out the gate.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed is that your affinity for technology has kind of also helped you to be on the forefront of all the changes that we've experienced since, say, 2010. You know, when Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act came into effect, even with the HVCC and the sunsetting of that, it has literally been pandemonium, if you will, in certain portions of real estate transactions. And appraisers really did take a big cut as far as not just pay or expenses that they had for doing business, but the methodologies and what they had to provide and the different levels of requirements that banks were now putting on their collateral, in this case, in order to secure that collateral with the different agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, you know, what FHA insures. And all of those things kind of culminated in this system known as appraising through AMCs or appraisal management companies. And from what I have seen as a loan officer, appraisers have not always been the most popular person in a transaction. And it kind of goes with the day of the week sometimes. If an appraisal comes in versus not coming in, either they're a friend or they're your foe. Or if you get a reputation, if you will, from certain people that either you bring things in or you don't bring them in. But I think we're going to dissect this a little bit more in this conversation to state that a lot of times it's not an appraiser's personal influence that comes in. It's what you can provide as documentation and the validity of what you're doing at the time that you actually do it. Am I wrong?
No, that's very true. Very true. In regards to the technology and the amount of work that goes into an appraisal now versus, let's say, 10 years ago, a lot has changed. Just to give you an example, I mean, to complete an appraisal now, it takes me about twice as long as it did in the early 2000s. There are just so many more requirements.
Sure.
The amount of information and level of detail is just a lot more heightened.
Yeah. And I see that. If anyone's taking the time to actually read through the appraisal versus just going to the value page and see if there's any conditions, there's a lot of data that you guys are inputting.
But there was one other thing that you touched on, and that is, you know, appraisers, I feel, are misunderstood.
Agreed. A lot. I totally agree. In this industry, they're 100%.
Yeah.
They're real people. Did you know that?
They are real people. They do have feelings.
Yeah.
No, but and I think part of the reason is because appraisers in general, I think as an industry, we've kind of, we haven't been very engaging. I like to say it like that. Maybe it's a matter of circumstance, right? We don't necessarily always have the opportunity to engage with the professionals that we work with. I think some appraisers are afraid to engage. But in reality, we're all just people. We're all just doing our jobs. And we all just want to do the best job that's possible, right? So one of the things I hope we can kind of cover or at least get to here is to kind of demystify what an appraiser is, what we're bound by, why we do some of the things that we do. And I think, you know, just sharing that information with others that, you know, indirectly or directly work with appraisers kind of will help ease that understanding and hopefully build a stronger bond.
Absolutely. So the listeners of the podcast, just so you know who our audience really is, it's going to be the general public. It could be a potential buyer, a potential seller.
Sure.
It could be someone specifically tied to our industry. It could be a listing agent. It could be a buyer's agent. It could be a title officer or escrow person. It could be other appraisers, believe it or not, home inspectors, other people that are related to the industry we're in. And the reason why this is important is we are all working towards a common goal. That is for a successful close to a transaction if an appraisal is required. They're not all transactions for real estate require an appraisal in the sense that a consumer may just pay cash for a property and may not even require an appraisal. But a bank, if they are involved, they want to make sure there's a proper valuation to justify why they're lending money on that collateral, right? So let's go ahead and just define for the user audience here, what is an appraisal?
Yeah, basically, I mean, I think you really explained it well in a nutshell. An appraisal is an opinion of value, and there are different types of opinions of value. What we're usually providing in the residential appraisal space is an opinion of market value,
mm-hmm.
right? So the opinion of market value is what you usually see in an appraisal report, and those opinions are requested by banks for mortgage transactions like a refinance or if a buyer wants to purchase a new property. So why does the bank want to know that opinion of market value? Well, it's basically risk management, right? So if the buyer of that house wants to borrow, let's just say $200,000, right? The bank or the lender wants to know, worst case scenario, what are they stuck with, right? Let's just say another mortgage crisis happens and property's going to foreclosure all over the place. Worst case scenario, if they have to take possession of that property, how much of their loan can they recoup?
Yeah.
Right.
I'd like to say this is an example, and I've talked about this in other podcasts, is that the bank is looking at not only the borrower, but they're looking at the end result. What is the worst possible case? So if you ever read a deed of trust, it actually shows remedies for mm-hmm. any losses, but also what would be required in case of default.
Right.
And that's going to be securing the property again, reselling it, but they're going to take any losses on. So we have mortgage insurance. That's what we use as a vehicle to protect us as lenders. And some people don't want to pay mortgage insurance. They feel they're entitled to not paying that mortgage insurance. But at the end of the day, he who has the purse of gold creates the rules. So the bank is the one with the money. They're the one at the highest level of risk, even though you may have put some money into the transaction. They are the ones that if they have to take that property back, have to have some reason why they're selling it for a particular value or what they have to cover as far as their obligation to it. So that makes total sense. So you've already kind of answered the question I was going to ask is why banks rely upon appraisals for valuation. It's really for securing and managing risk.
That's right.
Yeah. So
that's right.
And that's really what we look at it for. I mean, we're looking at it for our insuring purposes. There is a dual underwrite. People don't understand this much, but when we complete a loan approval, it actually goes to a mortgage insurance company if it's greater than 80%, and we have to have it duly underwritten because they're also going to check your work. They're going to check what we've evaluated the property at. So let's go ahead and ask this question. what are the basic types of evaluation methods? Meaning, are there different types of evaluation methods?
Oh, sure. There are different types of evaluation methods. The most common method that we use for residential real estate appraisals is the sales comparison approach. Mm-hmm. So watching some of these flipper-flop shows or things, you hear about comps. Sure. Comps. And what comps are comparable sales, right? So there's similar properties in the immediate market area that have recently sold that basically provide evidence of what that type of property with those type of features has sold for recently in the neighborhood, right? So that is our primary, our primary source of data when we use the sales comparison approach. There are other approaches to value. There isn't a whole lot of weight put on those in regards to mortgage-related transactions. There's the cost approach, in which you determine, you extract land value and determine the cost to rebuild that property or to build it up to a certain level of improvements, right? And then there's the income approach, and that's more relevant for income-producing properties. We're using gross rent multipliers and a number of other factors to determine value. But again, the most prominent one that we use and deal with on a daily basis is the sales comparison approach.
And when the sales comparison approach is used as being the primary, is what I'm hearing here, how important is having good data at your fingertips in order to create a report that's valid?
Yes, it's extremely important.
That was okay.
I think credibility is the word you want to use.
Sure.
Right? Because data is out there. But it's what's the best data, right? And so by being informed about the market in which you are practicing, right? Being familiar with that data and having access to the best data available, you provide a credible opinion of value, right? Based on fact, based on the best facts, based on the most recent relevant facts. So it's incredibly important to be up to date on what data is available and attributes and aspects of that specific market. Certain things that mean more in a certain neighborhood than they do in others. So education is highly, highly, it's one of the most important things, and something that we constantly try to work on and constantly try to learn more and more as Absolutely. Things become available.
So when you are getting this data and the integrity of the data, obviously, what defines the boundaries of an appraisal? Meaning, is there a specific location, a size, amenity, a neighborhood, a geographical distance that you're going? What boundaries are your starting points for every residential appraisal?
Very good question. I think this will demystify a lot of the appraisal process, right? Because we say comps and you hear comps and well, what is a comp? How do we determine what a comparable property is? Well, I like to think about it like this, right? Everyone's, I think, heard or familiar with the expression apples to apples, oranges to oranges,
sure,
that type of thing. So basically, what we want to compare is two similar properties. So there are certain types of attributes that we look for, and there are certain set of parameters that we work within. The best approach really is to work from in proximity, going from in to out. Okay, and let me explain. So in a neighborhood that's highly conforming, in which there are certain builders that have, or certain projects that have built up in a neighborhood, like of tract homes and stuff, your best comparables are going to be the closest ones within that same project or tract, right? The reason they're going to be the best comparables because they have similar quality of construction materials, similar design, similar overall market appeal. They were built by the same builder, right? So if a house, two blocks over, built by the same builder, sells for a certain value, you're pretty confident, right, in that being a good apples-to-apples comparison.
Sure.
To the property you're appraising, right? But in general, not all markets are like that. In fact, a lot of markets are not like that. There are some markets that have that do not have a high level of conformity, and so in those types of scenarios, there are other parameters that are the basics that we start with. And in general, you want to find the most similar properties to the property you're trying to value. You're trying to provide an opinion of value for. Parameters we start with is a half mile radius. proximity is really important. You guys have probably heard location, location, location. Location is important. It's huge, right? So we try to stay as close to the subject property, which is the term we use for the property we're appraising. We try to stay as close to the subject property as possible, and generally that's within a half mile radius. The other features we look at is number of bedrooms and bathrooms, and the overall gross living area of that property, right? So if you got a 2,000 square foot property, you basically want to stay within approximately a 15 to 25% range difference in gross living areas, right? So you don't want to compare a 3,500 square foot house to a 2,000 square foot house. It's not really apples to apples there, right? They're two totally different properties. You probably got two totally different buyers looking at those two things. So we start with the more stringent criteria, right? Half a mile, 15% difference in gross living area. We run the search of the relevant recent sales in the neighborhood. If we have enough data to provide a credible opinion of value based on that criteria, then we use that data. Now, sometimes you'll run that, you'll run half mile radius and you go, oh, wow, well, there's only two sales and one of them looks like a distress sale. So not enough information for me to really have a good idea what's going on in this market area.
So define distress sale, because it's important for listeners to hear this.
The seller is under some kind of duress to sell the property, right? The property might be a foreclosure. It might be a short sale where the buyer is underwater and can't pay the mortgage. It could be a court ordered sale. It could be a trust sale. There's a number of factors that go into the motivation of the seller, right?
So in those instances, it doesn't accurately represent the conditions of the market. It may be something that's an outlier, if you will, in that sense that it's not necessarily selling for what market data could support. Am I wrong in saying
exactly
that?
Exactly. It's not necessarily a good representation of a market of the market, right? Now, it could be. I'm not saying that any distressed sale
sure.
is not. There are certain times, especially during the housing crisis, where the majority of the properties on the market were distressed sales.
Sure.
Well, if the majority of the properties on the market for sale are distressed sales, then that's the market.
That is your market, absolutely.
So it's really context we're looking at as well. So back to that, we start with half mile radius, 15 to 20% difference in GLA. And if we have enough data, we use that data, come up with our opinion of value. Now, when there isn't enough data, that is how we justify expanding our parameters. And we have to have a reason and logic for everything that we do. You know, it's not, I can't just use a comparable a mile and a half away just because it supports an opinion of value. That's cherry picking. I'm not doing my job. I'm doing a disservice to that buyer. I'm doing a disservice to that lender, right? So anytime we expand our parameters beyond a half mile radius, beyond the 20% difference in GLA, we have to have a justification for it. There has to be a reason. And usually, in almost all instances in the appraisals I do in general appraisal practice, is there's commentary on that. You know, due to the recent relevant sales activity in the market area, the limited number of sales, the search parameters for the comparables was expanded to a 3/4 of a mile radius and included sales dating back up to 9 months. Mm. Right. So we're going a little bit further back to see what kind of sales activity has defined that market.
And those would be based on conditions in the market as well, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you kind of discussed this, but now that you've made that distinction for distance, conformity of subject property within a range, how do neighborhood defining lines or change in construction quality or neighborhoods that might be different or might have a different school district, how do those come into play, and how does that affect the end result? Or are there amenities per se that pull that outside of that conformity for any reason? Do those things ever play a role in valuation of a property as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely they do. You can have two very different neighborhoods being separated by a major street, right? So if you go south of that street, you typically see a 10% reduction in sales prices, right? Same property. Could be a number of factors. It could be school districts, as you mentioned, but it could also be certain amenities that neighborhood may have versus the other one. There are a lot of factors that go into it. Now, that data, right, when we're defining neighborhood boundaries, actually there's a neighborhood section in the report where we basically define what the neighborhood boundaries are. Like, you know, this street to the north, this street to the south, this street to the west, this street to the east. And in general, what we try to do is find data within that, in those neighborhood boundaries. That's the ideal world. Now, data is not always ideal.
Sure. Accurate.
Or accurate.
Yeah.
So sometimes I do have to go north of that street into that other neighborhood. But that's why it's really important to understand the markets that you're appraising in and the differences in marketability. And it's not to say I couldn't use a sale from that superior neighborhood, but I do have to understand the differences and make the appropriate adjustments, right, for the superior marketability of the property that's north of Street X,
mm-hmm.
right? So those are really good questions. Yeah.
So let's go into, say, the overall condition.
Yep.
So as you had indicated, there's something called the UAD. What is that defined as?
Well, the UAD is basically during the mortgage crisis, there was a need to standardize the way appraisers were writing their appraisals.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have seen an appraisal know that, you know, there are certain sections, but with descriptors in those sections, mm-hmm. right? And what you would get is you would get one appraiser describing that property as average, the other property would appraiser would describe it as, you know, average plus or typical or, you know, average to good.
Sure.
Average, you know, so there was a number of different ways that the same property was being described. There was no uniformity in it. So when UAD became a requirement for us, it was basically just a level of conformity. So instead of calling a property average or average to plus or average to good, right, now we have condition ratings. And the condition ratings are very well defined. So, you know, your average property that has some upgrades, has been generally well kept, not super remodeled or anything, would have a C4, for example, C4 condition rating. That would be, you know, your typical home with kept well, but, you know, not over the top or anything. Then you have a property that, you know, has a remodeled kitchen, the bathrooms have been redone, maybe new paint on the outside, roof is newer. Well, we have now a condition rating for that and a definition that encompasses that, right? And that would be a C3 property. These are a couple examples, but it makes it a lot easier for appraiser A and appraiser B to be on the same page when referring to either a comparable sale or a property they're appraising.
So those condition ratings have a consistency factor that brings in more than just one person's opinion. It may be across the board pretty consistent between appraisers as far as how they evaluate property. So a C2 rating may not be compared with a C4 all the time, but you can give a slightly more value perhaps for a C2 in your opinion based off of inspection, correct? So
yes.
This is off the topic, but it's related in a way. I have seen instances where there is an error that comes up in some documentation that we look at that states that this particular rating is materially different than other appraisals view. Basically, there's another appraisal that's in, say, Fannie's system that had a different condition rating. So then it asks for justification why your rating might be different for a subject of property. And I know after looking at these appraisals, there is commentary. It has to have some justification as to why the condition rating might be different or why this particular property is superior or inferior to this property that we're looking at. And those are all, I think, important things that agents need to understand as well as consumers need to understand. So you guys do have some uniform code, if you will, for what you're looking at, and it's a condition rating, right? And who oversees this, though? Is there a governing body? Is there anything that you know of that kind of looks at this stuff and says, okay, yeah, there's some conformity there, and what would create some consistency in the process?
Well, we have a standard set of definitions, and they should be in every appraisal report to give an understanding to the reader of what a C2 property means, right? Because otherwise, what is C2?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't know if I was in an appraiser. So it's well-defined. Now, within these definitions, not everybody will read that definition and look at a property and give it the same condition rating, right? We're all still human beings. And having said that, when we are providing an appraisal, we're providing an opinion of market value. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that we're making stuff up. That's not to say it's super subjective or, you know, it'll vary differently from one or another. But, you know, and I think some other appraisers, in the profession have talked about this. An appraisal is not an exact science. You know, we're not that good. I can't say this property is worth $252,484. I can't, you know? I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. But what I could do with more certainty is provide you a very narrow range. And in reality, a lot of people argue that a range is probably a little bit better. But I know for lending purposes, that doesn't always make things easy, right? But within a very acceptable range, let's just say 5% range, right? Let's just say my opinion of value was 240. Well, my peer's opinion of value on that was 235, right? We're still within an acceptable range. And that's what I mean, it's opinion of value. It's not an exact science,
yeah,
right?
And those things are somewhat subjective, I think, because one of the things that I've also noticed too is your data set and information that you're providing as source data for what you have to use in your reports may come from MLS comments, perhaps, or other information that's provided for closed sales.
Yeah.
So the accuracy of that data is also based off of completion of that transaction, updating information in the MLS and other note systems that you guys may have access to. Is that correct?
Sure, yeah, of course. The more information that we have, the better, or the more informed we are when developing an opinion, right? Yeah. And a lot of that, you know, is a matter, and it's gotten a lot better, I gotta say. It's gotten a lot better. A lot more agents are much more, they pay much more attention to the detail that they put into a listing, which is highly important for us. Especially in regards to certain special characteristics of the property or seller concessions and things of that nature that impact the terms of the sale. The more information we have, the more we have to work with.
Sure.
You know, when you look at two properties in the neighborhood and, you know, just at a quick glance, they look like, you know, the initial numbers look all the same. They're similar square footage, similar bedroom, bathroom count, but they're selling for $15,000, $20,000 difference, right? By having that information, you're able to look into, extract why that is the case. And so, you know, when you go into any neighborhood, you'll see a range of sales prices. Well, when you if you have adequate information, you're able to explain why.
Sure. Right?
And ideally, when you put that data into a report, even though there is a range of sales, not every sale in the neighborhood is going to be exactly the same, right? Once you make appropriate adjustments for the differences, like, hey, this property had a pool and sold for $250, this other property didn't have a pool, sold for $230, right? So you make a difference for those, you make an adjustment for those differences, that range, the adjusted value range, gets narrower and narrower. And the narrower your range, the more credible your opinion.
Sure.
Right?
So it's going back to my college days. It wasn't what I thought. It was what I could prove. So I had to go to source data.
Yep.
Today, everyone uses, I don't know, Wikipedia as being accurate.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's somebody that's updating that data. And I'm sure that what you have to go through may be confirmation in some senses. Maybe there is something that was missed in a report. And you have to go back to the subject property, or you have to go to a comparable and actually drive it just to say, hey, yeah, this really is materially different. There's characteristics that this particular subject may have that's a little different, or this is the reason why I think that perhaps that is not a valid comparable item. Because these are things that we as consumers, the definition of a sale of anything is, I agree to purchase what you have at a price that we mutually agreed the value is worth.
Right.
But then you have this thorn in your side called a lender that says, well, we have something to say because we're lending the money, right? So we use a third party independent source to validate that. And that would be your role as an appraiser. And I think that when you're going through this process, it's difficult and sometimes stressful for individuals to understand why you have to do what you have to do. So let me ask this question. You mentioned it, so we'll go through it real quickly. What are sales concessions, and do they affect how you evaluate a property?
Sure. So seller concession are certain terms of that sale that can either benefit buyer or seller, right? So let's say a buyer wants to go buy a property and they do the home inspection and they see that there are significant repairs to be made, right? Well, they agree to stick with the same sales price, but the seller agrees to, let's just say, credit the buyer $5,000 towards their closing cost to offset the amount of money that they would have to pay for those repairs. Okay. Right? So that's one example of a concession. And then your other part of your question, I think, was what impact and how do these impact valuations, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it really depends. It really depends how common these concessions are in the market area and the degree of the concession, right? You know, in California, typically seller concessions of 3% or less are not uncommon.
Yeah. In our marketplace, it's very, very common. You've seen on these appraisal requests, you read the contract and you'll see seller concession. Seller agrees to pay 2.5% towards buyer's closing costs, not to exceed $5,000. Just throwing a number out there, right?
Right.
So we as a lender are using those data points in order to construct our loan. So for example, if I have a buyer who needs to have seller assistance in order to have enough funds to close this transaction, if they come to the contract and they don't write those things in, and the agent delivers this executed contract, I'm going to turn around and tell the agent, I'm sorry, I can't fulfill the terms of this contract, so cancel it. That, in my opinion, is probably the worst thing you could ever tell somebody because they work so hard to get it into contract. But if they cannot close, it's useless to proceed, right?
Yeah.
So in that situation, perhaps one of the things that could be an issue is perhaps the house does not appraise. In the concession was the reason, because they pushed the value a little bit in order to give a credit, because a seller is looking at a seller's net, meaning after all expenses paid, this includes escrow, title, cost of commissions, any concessions the buyer is asking for, they're left with a net number. And they may look at one offer over another offer because of loan type, meaning it's a conventional loan versus a VA loan versus an FHA loan, but they're also looking at their bottom line and what concessions being asked for. So this is why I asked the question, does it have a value? Does it have an effect? You said it depends.
It depends, and I'll explain on that.
Okay. Okay.
Let's say a buyer is only able to afford a $300,000 home, right? Now, seller is stuck on their price of $310,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only way the buyer can buy that house for $310,000 if they get some cash at the close of escrow,
sure,
to help with their closing costs.
Sure.
Right? So they agree to spend $310,000 in the sales price as long as the seller gives them back, let's just say, $7,000.
Sure.
Right? Not $10,000, not the full thing, but or $6,000 to help offset their closing costs. And now, because they'll have that cash at the close of escrow to help offset the closing costs, they can now afford a $310,000 house. Right?
Yep.
So that seller concession had an impact on that sales price. That sale would not have happened without that sales concession.
Yes, I get it now. Okay. I agree with you. And that makes sense. So in some instances, I don't know if you see this often, but perhaps you're looking at what the list price was when it was listed.
Yes.
And then you see perhaps a price reduction.
Yes.
And then you see a sales price matching what their initial list price was, and then concessions. I mean, is that uncommon to see that happen?
It's not common, but I have seen it. You know, okay. I do see that sort of thing. And the reason is exactly kind of, you know, what the scenario we just went through. With that, the seller conceding and giving back to the buyer a certain amount of money to help offset their closing costs, they enable that buyer to, yes, make that purchase.
Yeah, and it creates, you know, activity in the market and actually has other closings for transactions which help out. So I think we've covered that, you know, topic pretty well. Let me ask this question now. When you're going through the process of evaluating property in general, and you know that the property has other amenities, and it's very clear in the listing description. For example, it has a pool.
Yeah.
But it doesn't just have a pool. It's got a grotto. It's got a spa. It's got a gazebo. It's got this whole backyard package that's $70,000, right? And then you've got another comp that has a pool. That's all it says.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or this property has solar, but its own solar versus a leased or a power purchase agreement solar.
Yes.
Maybe this house has, it's so airtight that, you know, it's literally its own vacuum. I mean, it is so energy efficient that it's head and shoulders above because they spent all these upgrade costs into it. Do these specific scenarios have any effect on value?
Absolutely. You certainly have to take these types of scenarios into consideration. There are some scenarios in which a property has upgrades where, you know, the backyard is turned into like a resort type.
Sure.
You know,
Mediterranean. Flamingos.
Yeah, I mean, they have gold-plated faucets and sure. things like that. In those scenarios where it's not typical or common for the market and you cannot find anything else similar to it, those are the types of things that we would consider an over-improvement for the area. Mm-hmm. You may have come across one house in the neighborhood that is, you know, most houses in the neighborhood are 1,500 square feet and they're selling at a, let's just say $300,000, and some guy builds a 7,000 square foot complex. There's nothing else like it in that neighborhood. That's what we consider an over-improvement for the market. But let's go back to the more practical application, right? Someone does spend a lot of money and does have a waterfall feature in the pool, and it's not overkill, but it's really nice. It's mm-hmm. not your common pool, right? So we go back to the search for comparable properties. I start looking within that half mile radius, within that 15 to 20% difference in GLA, and sales that have sold that are recent within the last 6 months. I try to find something that has that similar feature because I want to demonstrate, I have to provide evidence, right, to that lender why or how much impact that attribute has on the value or that sales price. Why is that buyer willing to pay that, right? I have to demonstrate that. I can't just go, oh, it's got a really nice pool, so it's 20 grand more.
Yeah.
At that point, if I'm doing that, I'm just making stuff up, okay? The opinions that we come up with, the value that we give to a certain attribute has to be extracted from the market. We have to have evidence for it. So if I don't find anything within that half mile radius, then I have some justification to expand my parameters slightly to see, okay, well, I can't find anything within a half mile radius. Can I expand my parameters to a 3/4 mile radius or a mile radius and find a competing neighborhood, something similar that has a similar marketability, which may have a property that has a similar feature, similar attribute, or a couple of attributes that improve its marketability and make it similar to the one that I'm trying to appraise, right? And if I do find one, let's hypothetically say I expanded the parameters, I found another property, and this property was selling for $320. It's about 3/4 of a mile away, right? And the other homes in the immediate neighborhood that had a regular pool were selling for $310, right? So how do I determine what adjustment I'm going to make for that regular pool versus the waterfall pool? The way we determine these type of adjustments we make, again, we have to provide evidence to the lender. And it's a process that we use called a matched pair analysis. The idea behind a matched pair analysis is you have two properties that are, for all intents and purposes, are the same except for one attribute. And so when you're comparing the properties and their sales prices, you see one sold for $310, you see one sold for $320. The only difference is one has a regular pool and the other one has a waterfall pool, right? And so we're able to extract the market impact, right, of that attribute by comparing two similar properties with difference in one attribute, right? And then when I go to write the appraisal, I can still use that comp that was closer and you know, more similar to the subject in every aspect except the waterfall pool in the report. I can still put that in my as a comparable. But then I will also include the one that was a little further away, and I put that in the report as well. And I can make an adjustment to the one that had the regular pool And now I can demonstrate and provide evidence why I made a $10,000 adjustment. Even though they also had a pool, you know, we were able to demonstrate that waterfall feature in the pool and the water slide or whatever it was,
sure,
right, had a market impact. And that's called a mash pair analysis.
So here's another quick question. So let's say gross living area is the same.
Yeah.
But you have a two-story versus a single-story.
Yeah.
One that has a two-car garage versus a three-car garage, or a two-car garage with a pull-through or extended garage. How are those adjustments made? And the reason why I ask is this is a good example for me to mm-hmm. think about because I just don't know the answer. But if I'm actually trying to help somebody with the refinance of a property,
yeah.
they're asking me to give them an estimate of value. I'm like, well, I have no clue until I look up some comparables. But the comparables are telling me 4 and 2. It tells me year built, square footage, and you know it's in this area. But it doesn't tell me if it's a two-story, single-story. It doesn't tell me if it has three-car garage, two-car. So is an appraiser going to be looking at those as value add items, one being superior versus the other? What does that do to an appraisal?
That's a very market specific question.
Okay.
In some markets, it makes absolutely no difference if that square footage is over two stories or one. In some markets, it makes a massive difference, right? So our job is to do a market analysis, neighborhood analysis, right? So you're taking, and the way we would do that is, let's just say we want to see if there's a difference between single story homes and two story homes, right? So what we would do is we would do a market analysis and take all the single story homes that have sold in the last 6 months, right? With a certain set of parameters. Let's just say they're all approximately 1800 square feet, right? And then we take all the two story homes that are approximately the same bedroom, bathroom count, same square footage. And we compare those to the median price of those two subsets, right? And if there is no difference, then we determine that whether it's a two-bedroom or one-bedroom, in this market, buyers don't care.
Mm.
Now, you may be in some, it really also depends on the demographic of the market, right?
Sure.
Certain markets, people don't want to go upstairs for
yeah.
whatever reasons, right? And in those markets, those differences certainly do have an impact on value. So one of the important things is being educated in the markets that you're appraising. And also communicating with other professionals in the area. You know, when in doubt, ask.
Sure, absolutely.
Communicate.
The more information you have, I think the better your justification or your data set's going to be.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the important things is too, you know, when I'm researching a property, if there's anything that doesn't make sense to me, I'm not afraid to pick up the phone and call a listing agent and go, why did this property sell more than that property two streets over?
Mm-hmm.
And usually that provides me some really great insight.
And that, I think, is just key. We've talked about this kind of before the podcast, is that communication really does make your job much more realistic as far as what you're trying to accomplish. Now, if it's just really off, I mean, you have to have a reason why a house could be evaluated much more. It's very important that you communicate with the parties that are involved if it's necessary. And you also made a point that In our market locally in Kern County, you've noticed that a lot of the stuff is on lockbox and they don't necessarily want to necessarily meet you out there. Well, perhaps that is necessary in certain real estate transactions because the property is unique in some way and where there are comps that went slightly above what other sales in the area might support. And could that be some of value to you to meet with the agent and actually get some information from them?
Well, I tell you, you know, from a practical standpoint, like being able to go and access a property with a lockbox is much more convenient for everybody
sure.
involved, right? We don't have to coordinate schedules. If I'm running a little late or running a little early, it's okay. I can do it on my time and all that. And agents don't have to bother meeting an appraiser on the property. But I tell you what, from experience, I highly recommend agents to meet the appraiser at the property. And there's a couple reasons. One, it's always good for the appraiser to have all the insight, that as much insight they can about the property, right? There's sometimes when we walk through the property, we don't know that there's copper plumbing there, right? We don't know certain things have been done to the property that have upgraded the property. We don't know that stuff because we can't see through the walls. In addition to that, a lot of agents, you know, work exclusively in certain neighborhoods or know markets so well, right? They even know of sales that are about to happen that we don't even know about. Right? And this insight can help inform an appraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is the more opportunity we have to get everybody on the same page in regards to what data is being considered, right, the less surprises you get in the end.
Sure.
So one of the things I like to do as well, I definitely like to meet an agent when I go to the property. I always like to also ask the agents, you know, if they would like to share with me any sales that they're familiar with that they'd like me to consider. You know, a lot of times the agents are helping the seller determine that listing price, right, by informing them with certain data that they have. And so it's good for the appraiser to know, well, where was their mind at? Where was their head at? Where did they come up with that value? So then I can look at it, and I may agree or disagree. It's not to say that I go, oh, great, well, there it is. Well, it's my job to determine the relevance of that information, sure, right? But I think it's really, really important to all be on the same page. And another thing that I personally value is personal accountability.
Sure.
When you look somebody in the eye and you shake their hand, I feel personally accountable to providing you my best. Absolutely. I want to do my best. You're not just a loan number. You're not just an appraisal order that came through my desk. You're a person that has a goal, you know, and are trying to do their job. And I want to be able to do the best I can to help you achieve that.
Yeah, and I think that's what separates you, I think, from a lot of other people in your industry, is that you are taking more of a personal approach to actually help people. I mean, this is, at the end of the day, not only responsibility you have to your profession, but also to the people that we serve. But at its core, you are a person trying to do your job to the best of your ability. And I think people see that and they feel that. So that's really a cool thing that you bring up. So let's get into kind of some detail things, and we'll kind of slash through these pretty quick. What are some basic standard property condition requirements that the state mandates, the things that need to be in the property? And is there a distinction between government-insured loans like FHA versus conventional? Can you touch on those?
Yeah, I'll briefly cover some of the differences. I'm mostly familiar with the requirements of the state of California. Mm-hmm. For example, in California, properties required to have their water heaters are required to be double-strapped, and that's because we have earthquakes here.
Sure.
So as part of health and safety, if a water heater is not double-strapped, usually the lender requires us to condition for that to happen before they're able to loan on it, right? Fund that loan. Another state specific requirement is in California is a carbon monoxide detector. A few years ago, you didn't need one,
sure,
right? But now, single family homes are required, and condominiums for that matter, and multifamily properties are required to have a carbon monoxide detector in the home. Smoke detectors have been a prerequisite for a really long time, so that I'm sure everyone's familiar with that. In regards to FHA loans and federally insured loans, they have more stringent requirements. Most of those have to do with health and safety.
Sure.
So property built before 1978 that has peeling paint could have lead-based paint in it, right? So if we come to a property and we see a property is paint chipping and stuff like that, we have to call out, we are required actually to call out any potential health and safety issues, right? That's a requirement that FHA or HUD actually puts upon us. On a conventional loan, we would note that stuff, but that isn't a condition of the appraisal, right? And a lot of times, I wanna go through this too. A lot of times, like, you know, I wanna demystify this. We as appraisers, our job is to determine, well, it's to give our opinion about health and safety. If we see an apparent health and safety issue, we have to note it, right? And provide that information to the lender. But if a property has a broken window, which is a health and safety issue, right? For me, I'm not a governing body that's going to require that person to fix that thing before I give them the opinion of value. No, really, a broken window, I mean, you can call some guy and he'll fix it, and it's going to cost you less than $100, right? In most instances. It's not that big of a deal. It doesn't have a huge impact on the overall marketability of the property. My opinion of market value is still credible and relevant, right? But the lender has their own requirements. The lender has their own things that they need to cross off their list, right? So we get directives and we get guidance from the lenders that, for example, if the water heater straps are missing, make that appraisal report subject to that property getting double strapped, because the lender knows that they're going to have that done before, you know, they can fund that loan.
Yeah.
So we're not we're not creating conditions for the appraisal in general. I'm speaking on my personal side. Like, I don't just throw roadblocks into the appraisal. These are generally guidance that we get from a client or lender that says, if you come across this scenario, please treat it this way.
Well, I think just knowing what you just said, it does clarify in my mind that appraisers are not out there trying to add additional conditions. It's actually something that is required based off the loan type that they're completing. And in order for a lender to close that loan, they have to have it insured, and they will not have it purchased off their warehouse lines for Fannie or Freddie on conventional loans unless certain requirements are met. FHA will not insure that loan as a saleable loan unless certain requirements are met. So those distinctions are very, very important. So thank you for spending the time on that.
Sure.
So there's a term called USPAP. What does that refer to?
USPAP refers to Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, right? Mm-hmm. So it's basically a set of standards that us appraisers are supposed to live by. And the primary purpose of USPAP is to maintain the public's trust. We have to have a certain level of integrity and trust within the public for our opinions to be valued. I mean, for people to put weight on our opinion.
Sure.
If we're not operating by a certain set of standards, and everyone's doing their own thing, then why would you trust appraiser A versus appraiser B, right? So what USPAP does, gives us guidance in how we go about maintaining the public trust. I think that's its most important function.
So it's a code of ethics in a way too, and a standard that you guys all abide by, correct?
Sure.
So being licensed, it's required that you guys do continuing education based off of current standards and appraisal practices, but also that you're in tune with changes that the lending community is requiring of you, that you can then basically amend your practices to conform with what's required for the banks. Is that correct?
Yeah, and basically a lot of the changes in USPAP is to make that appraisal report more understandable to the intended user, right? So there are certain times where we had guidance to do something a certain way, but after a few years in practice, it was realized that actually was kind of confusing and people didn't get what we were saying. And so, yes, there is a process with USPAP and it does change periodically. They have a process by which it does change. But we are required every 2 years to take a class and be up to date on the current standards.
I can tell you, just having read a lot of real estate periodicals and data, information is stating that to become an appraiser today is virtually impossible. Like, literally what they're asking for is baseline requirements is actually unreal. And I see that you, as a community of professionals, are really dying out.
I got to tell you, I got to say, I'm going to speak up about this because I do think that's a massive problem in our industry. The requirements and what we need to be a licensed appraiser, it is crazy.
It really is.
So I'll give you an example. I think if you think this is important for your listeners to understand. So in order for an appraiser to become a licensed appraiser, not a trainee or an apprentice, but a licensed appraiser, you need a minimum of 2,000 hours of experience working with a supervisor. 2,000 hours of experience.
Sure. That's a full year of nonstop full-time.
That's right. And the way that the guidelines are set up right now, as a supervisor, for me to bring on another appraiser and bring him into the industry, I have to basically hold that person's hand for a minimum of a year and take them on every assignment with me, right? And then pay that person.
Sure.
To help them become an appraiser. And one of the challenges that you see in our industry, and why a lot of appraisers are not doing that, and why the appraiser pool is shrinking,
sure,
is because if I were to invest that amount of time into an apprentice, there's no guarantee that once that apprentice gets licensed and is able to do the same thing that I do, there's no guarantee that person will stick around.
Yeah.
So what you see now happening is, generally, when new appraisers are coming into the industry, it's being handed down from father to son or family member or somebody like that, which is a problem because our profession is not really growing, and a significant portion of the appraisers currently practicing are now getting to the age where they're, you know, looking towards possibly retirement, right?
Sure.
So I hope that some progress can be made about that, because I mean, in my opinion, I don't think 2,000 hours is required before, you know, you kind of know what you're doing. It certainly wasn't, let's just put it this way. I think that after 6 months, 3 to 6 months, you have a pretty good grasp on what's going on. And we used to be able to do that, right? So back in the early 2000s, when I got into the profession, you were still an apprentice. You still needed the 2,000 hours. But after 3 months, after 6 months, when your supervisor felt you were able to spread your wings and try to go fly, you were able to go out in the field, do an inspection, come back, try to write the report. Of course, the supervisor would review the appraisal, look over everything. But at least you had a chance to fly, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was really a great way for us to learn.
I think it was a more realistic way of doing things, yeah, too, because there's an apprentice-master relationship, and that mentorship is necessary, obviously. But you also, as you know, a senior appraiser overlooking an apprentice, are double-checking the work anyways, because the quality needs to be there in order for your stamp to be on there, because you're ultimately the one licensed that has responsibility for the overseeing of that particular result. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. I just see that there's a big hole, and it's coming, where we're going to lose even more appraisers, and we're not going to be able to replace them quick enough in order to have longevity and turn times, the ability to complete things on a reasonable basis and at a reasonable cost too. Let's be perfectly honest with you. If you have high demand and low availability, cost goes up.
Now, in all fairness, you know, and just to clarify, you know, the 2,000 hour requirement is still the same, but back then we used to, after like, you know, 500, 1,000 hours, you were able to go out and appraise a property on your own and come back, and then your supervisor would sign off on it. Now you cannot go out to doing a property on your own now for most lenders, unless you've done the 2,000 hours, yeah, with somebody else. So that's really the difference. I hope things change. There are people in the industry that are really trying to help make progress in that regard, because it is a problem. I mean, it is something that has to be addressed, yeah, at some point.
Well, we're almost complete. Just quick, sure, question for you. This is kind of in parting. It says, is there any piece of advice that you'd give a homeowner before an appraiser shows up to that home to do the appraisal? Is there anything that you recommend be done? I mean, I don't want to give you an example so much as say, is there anything that you like to see as far as things before you go out to the property have done?
Well, I'm gonna say this. I'll leave the audience with a few things that I think are impactful or good for them to know as far as an appraisal. In general, I mean, look, if I come to your house and your kids made a mess and everything, I'm not looking at that to appraise your value. I'm not really doing my job if I'm doing that. So things that you can do like that, you know, it's not the same as like when you're showing a house in an open house and you want it to be perfect and you want your put water on your driveway and make it look pretty. We as appraisers have different lenses on. We're looking at different things, right? But certain things I think is good for homeowners to know are things that they can put money into that really give them the most return, mm-hmm, right? And I think some of those things are, look, everybody, copper plumbing and upgrading your electrical panel and everything is great, right? But in terms of market value and what the market says that investment was worth, it's not always the same as putting money into a kitchen or bathrooms, right? Or a new coat of paint on the exterior of property. Things that improve the curb appeal and that when someone walks into the house makes it feel more updated and current, those things tend to have the most return. And those things tend to impact the overall marketability of a property more than some of the under the hood improvements. That's not to say under the hood improvements are not important, but I'm talking about dollar for dollar return. If you're, and not, I'm saying you're not that you get dollar for dollar market return, but that to maximize the impact of your investment, I would focus on some of those aspects.
Yeah, and I would agree with that 100% because they do say kitchens and bathrooms sell homes, but also have the greatest value of return on your investment. But I can also say that a clean house, something that shows well, that is decluttered or has, you know, fresh paint and the carpets, you know, clean, all of these factors show pride of ownership, and the condition may be slightly different, even though the house is in good condition. You know, the perception is important. So homeowners that takes pride in that prior to the inspection also, you know, gets those things done. And if anything, the real estate agents also need to prep the homeowner before that inspection. So this appraiser is going to be going through the property, so be aware of that. They're going to be taking pictures. They're going to be taking measurements. They may not interact with you much. That's not a personality issue. It's just they have a job to do, and we're not supposed to influence value or anything so much as say, hey, I appreciate you taking the time to open your home. We're going to be expedition what we're going to do. We're going to get this completed so that we can get this back to your lender as quickly as possible, or that, you know, whoever's doing the financing. What else I want to ask is just a parting thing. As far as the general experience you've had as an appraiser, have you seen that agents that you work with or clients that you interact with are appreciative of the work that you do?
Absolutely. I think a lot of appraisers are afraid to engage in conversation.
Sure.
I think that a lot of them are afraid that they're going to be influenced in certain ways. And sometimes they forget that we're all just people, you know, we all go home at night, you know, and we all have family and friends that love us. And, you know, we're all just the same, really. So have a communication, having a relationship with someone opens the door for everyone being on the same page. And educating each other, I think, is a really important thing. Asking questions is okay. You know, nobody likes to be the annoying appraiser. The annoying appraiser is calling you about every little nitpicky thing.
Sure.
I'm not talking about that. But I'm just talking about, like, you know, communicating with the agent. You know, when you don't understand something in the neighborhood, it's okay. Like, you know, we are not supposed to know everything all the time. We're constantly learning in every aspect of the profession, whether you're an agent, whether you're an appraiser. So I think communication is super important. Relationship is super important. People generally tend to and like to work with people they enjoy, you know, interacting with.
Yeah.
So I think just connecting on a human level, even though we're all doing our jobs and being objective and maintaining high integrity, I think the human element is something that sometimes people forget to put focus on.
I totally agree. And I just want to thank you so much, Mark, for your time and energy here. I think that the listeners of this podcast can get a lot out of it. I think if you humanize this process, it becomes very, as I would say, sterile, meaning you are doing not only a service for the client, the bank, but you're also helping House America. And I say that because without your efforts and what you do, people are not closing on homes. You're creating community. And I think people don't realize that. You are an integral part for someone's home that creates the lifetime memories that they have in building families in an environment where they can raise their families and have their kids go to school and experience life as a homeowner. So I thank you for that, and I appreciate your time. And
we'll have
you come back when I have this frequently asked questions section. We'll do like one of those, jettison through all of these questions and kind of get some of these hard to answer questions that I can't think of right now. But
well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation back and forth. And you know, as appraisers, we provide an opinion of value for the probably the most important investment you will make in your life. So for us, just as much as it is to provide a credible opinion to the bank, it is our service and our duty to provide a credible opinion to the homeowner as well.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much, Mark, and I look forward to hearing the end result of this podcast.
Awesome.